The Rothbardian analysis of the state, and I thought it'd be fitting to talk about Murray Rothbard's views on, some of his views anyway, on war. And he did a lot of writing on the subject, of course, and like I said on the chat, I think the articles I put on there are not too laborious and not too lengthy overall, and they give you a good introduction of Murray Rothbard's libertarian thinking about war. And I guess the most most controversial one, of course, would be his essay on just war, especially for those of you who are not that familiar with my writings on Lincoln, beginning with my 2002 book, The Real Lincoln, and my later book, Lincoln Unmasked, which I consider to be totally in the Rothbardian tradition of the analysis of the so-called Civil War. If you read the essay on Just War by Rothbard, you'll know that, and if you have read some of my writings on it, you know that we were totally in sync on the some of the main issues. And as an interesting aside, one of the last things that Joey Rothbard did before she died, she still remained active in reading and writing and even making presentations at the Mises Institute. And a year or two before she died, she wrote a big long paper on Lincoln and the Civil War, and that's what she was into at the end of her life, interestingly enough. And she and I were in sync also, because there was no bigger student of Murray Rothbard than his wife Joey. And I think, I don't know, maybe it's up on lewrockwell.com or mises.org. I haven't looked for Joey's writings in a long time. I know she did have a big, long paper. I don't even recall, though, if it was ever published anywhere. But it might be worth looking at if it's on Mises.org somewhere. So the first thing I thought I'd do is talk about Rothbard, the neo-Confederate, as he would be sneered as today if he were writing these things today. And this is a classic Rothbard article that combines history, political philosophy, economics, and even an understanding of religion in his discussion of the post-millennialists of the 19th century. And I guess the first point I would make is to reiterate one of the subtle points that Murray makes here in this essay, in kind of in passing, in that there was a difference between the cause of the American Civil War and the cause of secession of the Southern states. You know, any war has multiple causes, and if you took a university course on the American Civil War in the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s, there's a good chance that you used one of the textbooks you used was a book called The Causes of the Civil War by Kenneth Stamp, spelled with two P's, and it's Causes, plural, of the Civil War. It's a collection of essays and government documents from the era, from the 19th century, that lays out all the multiple reasons for the war. And it's become politically correct today to rewrite the history in sort of a cartoonish version that says the one sole cause of the war was the desire on the part of Northerners to sacrifice everything for the benefit of black strangers in the South, namely the slaves. But that's historical. That's not true. There were multiple causes of war. Slavery was not the only issue. And to separate the issues of secession and war, there were a lot of issues for reasons for secession that you could cite. Murray Rothbard talks about the tariff issue as one. Southerners also wanted to do with the slavery issue what the Northerners had done. The Northerners had dealt with slavery state by state, and Southerners wanted to do the same thing. The Confederate Constitution, by the way, allowed any state to come into the Union, either with slaves or without. That was not true of the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution did enforce the system of slavery from 1789 until 1866. It didn't explicitly support slavery, but it certainly implicitly did, because there was never a serious constitutional challenge in the courts to slavery that amounted to much of anything. It was protected by the U.S. Constitution. And so some of the Southern states, when they seceded, they mentioned the issue of slavery, saying they wanted to do with slavery what they felt was right. And of course, there were slave states. But New York had just ended slavery about 5 or 6 years earlier. And so the hands of New Yorkers were not exactly saintly on the issue of slavery, nor were those of a lot of other New Englanders and Northerners who profited from the slave system. Also, Murray Rothbard was knowledgeable of the fact that in his first inaugural address, Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, did not mention the issue of slavery at all, but he did mention the issue of the tariff, and he made a very powerful case for free trade and against protectionism, when at the same time, Abraham Lincoln made an ironclad defense of slavery in his first inaugural address, and I welcome you all to read it. At the same time, he threatened war and invasion and bloodshed, those are his exact words, over tariff collection. And Rothbard mentioned this in his essay. For example, in Lincoln's first inaugural address, he said, "It is my duty to collect the duties and imposts, tariffs, but beyond that, there will be no invasion of any state." And so if you look at those exact words, what he's saying is there will be an invasion if you do not collect the tariff. Because what he actually said was there won't be an invasion as long as you do collect the tariff, which, by the way, had just been more than doubled 2 days earlier. The moral tariff bill had been signed into law by President James Buchanan 2 days before Lincoln was inaugurated. And so the average tariff rate went from about 15%, 1.5, to 32.6%. And then, as Rothbard puts on this essay, it was raised 10 times more during his presidency, so that by the time Lincoln left office, the average tariff rate was close to 50%. And it remained in that range, in the 40 to 50% range, until 1913, when the income tax was adopted. And so this was a big cause of the war in the eyes of Abraham Lincoln and in the eyes of Jefferson Davis, the president of the southern states during the American Civil War era, as Rothbard points out. And so when he makes the case that the American Civil War was a just war, he means from the perspective of the southern side. He doesn't say it was a just invasion of the southern states. He said the southern states were just or justified in defending themselves against the northern invasion. He also mentions the true fact of how Lincoln manipulated South Carolinians into firing the first shot at Fort Sumter, where no one was hurt, let alone killed. And then Lincoln used that to respond to a full-scale invasion of all the southern states that ended up killing at least 350,000 Southerners. Sort of a disproportionate response to the crumbling of some bricks at Fort Sumter. And Rothbard does point out that one of the purposes of forts like Fort Sumter was to provide military support for tariff collection at the Customs House, which was in Charleston, South Carolina, right on the water, right at the foot of Charleston Harbor. And it is still there to this day. And there's a very nice seafood restaurant on a pier right opposite the Customs House in Charleston, South Carolina today. And I recommend the restaurant to anyone who visits Charleston. It's a neat location and good southern cooking, too. I've been there several times recently. And so Rothbard understood this, that Lincoln wanted a war over tariffs. He threatened war literally over tariff collection. And then when the South, of course, refused to send money to Washington, D.C., once they established their own country, they were not about to send tax tributes to Washington, D.C. any more than the British, French, or the Dutch were. Lincoln invaded to enforce tax collection, and he kept his promise. This is not the standard story that is told, because most historians almost totally ignore the first inaugural address, because in addition to being a threat of war over a tax collection, it is what I think is the strongest defense of slavery ever made by an American politician, because it came from the president, and in that speech, the president, Lincoln, supported the Corwin Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And what the Corwin Amendment did, what it would have done, would have been to prohibit the federal government from ever interfering in slavery at all. And that was Lincoln's amendment. He actually instructed William Seward, his Secretary of State, to get that amendment through the United States Senate. And this is not a controversial issue. Even Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's quite a Lincoln idolater, writes about it in her book, Team of Rivals. And she writes about it approvingly, though, because the theme of her book is what a slick manipulator and clever liar Lincoln was. And this is one example she gives of what a slick manipulator and conniver and liar he was. And so she thinks that's a virtue, not a vice. And Rothbard also saw through the phony libertarianism of Lincoln. There are some libertarians who claim to be Lincoln supporters, but it's hard to think of anything Lincoln actually did along the lines of libertarianism or freedom. Even the ending of slavery, of course, which took place as a result of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution when the states ratified it after the war, after Lincoln's death. Rothbard points out that the United States was the only country in the world in the 19th century that ended slavery in any kind of process that had anything to do with a war. And slavery was ended, but why didn't we do in the United States what every other country, what the British, the French, the Danes, the Dutch, the Swedes, all did in the northern states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, New York, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Illinois, they had slaves in all of those states at one time, and they all found a way to end slavery peacefully, mostly by finding a way of buying the freedom of the slaves, buying out the slave owners, and ending the whole system. But that was never a serious consideration on the Lincoln regime, because as Rothbard points out in the essay, an important part of the political constituency of the North was the hotheads in the so-called post-millennialist movement, who were known as the Yankees. These were people who thought that in order to have a 1,000-year kingdom of God on earth that would precede the second coming of Jesus Christ, you needed to have perfection on earth, heaven on earth. And that meant getting rid of sin, and that included, of course, the sin of slavery, and also the sin of rum, of drinking alcohol, and also, equally importantly, the Catholic Church. That's why rum, Romanism, and rum and Romanism were sort of a rallying cry eventually behind the post-millennialists of the late 19th century. They wanted to get rid of the two things after they got rid of slavery. So it was a moral crusade, not so much motivated to benefit the poor slaves, but it was a religious crusade that these people thought would benefit them personally in speeding up their ascent to heaven. That's why they rejected any pragmatic approach to phase out slavery in 5 or 6 years through compensated emancipation, as the British did, for example, barely 20 years earlier from the start of the American Civil War in 1861. So Rothbard writes about all this in the essay. He doesn't always devote a lot of time to it in the essay, but he mentions all of these points. And on the issue of how the other countries of the world ended slavery, I would recommend Jim Powell's book, Greatest Emancipations. It talks about how all the other countries of the world ended slavery peacefully without enduring the cost of war. And of course, Rothbard was very keen as an economist in pointing out the cost, explicit and implicit, of war. And of course, the cost of the American Civil War, or more than just all the deaths. And by the way, the latest estimates of the amount of deaths are all the way up to about 800,000 or more American deaths during the Civil War. For years and years, the historians said it was more like 650,000. But modern researchers have taken a closer look at that, and now the number is up closer to 800,000 at a time when the population of America was about one-tenth of what it is today. So if you standardize today's population, and the death toll would be more like 8 million in just under 4 years, north and south, both sides on the war. And so and Rothbard also talks about the importance of tariff history. It shouldn't be a shock to anyone that Rothbard pinpoints an economic issue as an important cause, not the sole cause, but an important cause of the war. And every time I write about this, by the way, the Lincoln defenders lie about what I say, and they'll claim that I claim that there was one and only reason for secession and one and only reason for the war, tariffs, which is untrue. I've never said or written any such thing. But there are an awful lot of liars out there on the internet and elsewhere who just lie through their teeth about these things because apparently they're capable of constructing a logical argument or coming up with evidence that contradicts some of the things that I've written. And so, the tariff history is important because it really starts with the tariff of abominations in 1828 when South Carolina refused to collect the big tariff of that day, which increased the tariff rate to almost 45%. That almost led to a breakup of the union over tariff collection. And then the tariff was negotiated down for many years after that, so that by the time you get to 1857, the tariff was at the lowest rate of the 19th century, about 15% on average. And one of the first things the Republicans did upon gaining power in Washington was to pass the Morrill Tariff Bill in the 1859-1860 session of Congress, in which they increased the tariff rate again. They thought higher tariffs, higher taxes, would be a good antidote to the Depression of 1857. And so their economics was totally cockeyed and off base on that. Tax increases are never a good idea during the Depression. It was a bad idea for the economics of that day or the economics of any day. But they succeeded eventually, so that 2 days before Lincoln was inaugurated, they got their tariff more than doubled. So, at the time, the tariff accounted for about 90 to 95% of all federal tax revenue. So the government is saying, we have more than doubled the tax rate, federal tax rate, for all practical purposes. 95% of all revenue came from the tariff. And then Lincoln announces, if any of you consider not paying this newly doubled federal rate of taxation, we will invade. He says that in his first inaugural address. How anyone could read the first inaugural address and conclude that the tariff had nothing whatsoever in any way to do with why there was a war is beyond me. You have to be a liar or a grossly incompetent writer and researcher to come to that conclusion, in my view. And so the tariff history is important. And of course, if you look at the other things Lincoln did, his whole life he was a champion of protectionism. He was a champion of central banking. He signed off on the National Currency Act and the Legal Tender Acts during his time. He introduced the first federal military conscription law. The South had military conscription too, but this was the first federal military conscription law, the first federal income tax. He created the Internal Revenue bureaucracy that we live to and suffer under to this day. The phrase the New Deal was not originally meant to describe Franklin Roosevelt. It came from a North Carolina newspaper that described all of the domestic policy interventions of the Lincoln administration, including the creation of the Department of Agriculture, the enlargement of the post office. And so Lincoln was a massive interventionist in economic policy. He implemented the entire Whig program of massive corporate welfare for the railroad corporations, high protectionist tariffs, high taxes, high debt, pervasive excise taxes, and on civil liberties, he was an absolute nightmare, the worst ever in American history. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus and has had soldiers mass arrest tens of thousands of northern political dissenters, throwing them into dungeons and prisons without any due process whatsoever for indeterminable amounts of time. He imprisoned a member of Congress, Clement Vallandigham of Ohio, for merely opposing his tyrannical behavior with the illegal and unconstitutional suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. When the Chief Justice of the United States, Roger B. Taney, issued an opinion that the suspension of habeas corpus was unconstitutional, Lincoln issued an arrest warrant for Judge Taney. He confiscated firearms in the border states in violation of the Second Amendment. And in fact, the entire invasion of the southern states was a violation of the Second Amendment because James Madison himself said that the main reason for the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms was to deter any future federal invasion of the sovereign states. And so Lincoln violated that. He waged war without the consent of Congress also. And that is just a short list of the constitutional destruction that occurred during the Lincoln administration. My book, Lincoln Unmasked, I quote Lincoln directly as saying, even a man who stands still and says nothing while his administration is being discussed is a traitor, is guilty of treason. And that was exactly what the tyrannical governments of the communist world did. And by the way, I see some of you in the chat are talking about Bill O'Reilly. I'm reading his book now and taking notes, and I'll be reviewing it on LouRockwell.com in a few days. I don't know if I'll be taking on Bill O'Reilly, but I'm going to review his ridiculous book anyway, sometime in the next week or so. And so no wonder Murray Rothbard, Mr. Libertarian, looks at Abe Lincoln, who failed to do the peaceful thing with regard to slavery and end it peacefully. Why not? Southern slave owners were not any more barbaric than British slave owners or Dutch slave owners or Swedish slave owners or Dutch slave owners. And in fact, the slavery system, you have to understand the economics of it, has only benefited a very tiny fraction of Southerners. That was the slave owners. They're the ones who exploited the labor of the slaves. But the typical Confederate soldier, for example, was a yeoman farmer who did not own slaves. And he was actually harmed by the system because he had to compete with the large slave plantations in the farming business. And also, if he was a laborer, he had to compete for jobs with slaves who, of course, worked for free as slaves. That's why Abraham Lincoln himself championed the cause of keeping slavery out of the new territories. One of the reasons he gave is, in his own words, he wanted to keep slavery, or the territories rather, the domain of his, in Lincoln's words, free white labor. And that's a direct quote from Abe Lincoln. And what he was doing is pandering to labor market protectionism. He was saying, we are not going to allow competition for your jobs in the new territories or anywhere in the North. And so that was his position. There's nothing at all libertarian about that. Lincoln's home state of Illinois suspended the writ of, amended its constitution, in 1848 to make it illegal for black people to enter the state, which they did not, of course, legally. And he supported that. He also was one of the managers of something called the Illinois Colonization Society, which sought to deport all the free black people out of the state of Illinois using tax dollars to do so, and they did. And of course, Lincoln was infatuated with so-called colonization his whole life. I recommend the book Colonization After Emancipation to anyone who's interested in this topic, just published last year by Philip Magness, M-A-G-N-E-S-S, and a co-author from Oxford University. And they prove that to his dying breath, Lincoln was planning and plotting to deport the freed slaves somewhere, anywhere but here in the United States. He wanted to make Panamanian coal miners out of them, apparently, at one point. He also entertained the idea of forcing them to dig a canal in Panama decades before the actual Panama Canal was dug out. And so he was a lifelong advocate of essentially deporting all the black people out of America. And any time he did talk about compensated emancipation, which is the whole rest of the world, including the northern states, did to end slavery, it was always coupled with immediate deportation. And Abe Lincoln did not believe a multiracial society was either possible or desirable. And of course, Murray Rothbard knew this. And that's why he, like I, thought it was a big joke to make Abe Lincoln out to be some sort of racial saint, let alone a libertarian. And of course, any politician can use nice sounding language. Abe Lincoln was either an atheist or an agnostic. His wife and his law partner, the two people who were closest to him in his lifetime, both said he never became a Christian, he never joined a church, and it's really kind of a joke to think of him as a Christian, but he knew how to use religious rhetoric in his speeches in order to sway the crowds during his time. He was very good at that. Also, another thing that Lincoln did that Rothbard would disapprove of, obviously, was intentionally waging war on Southern civilians for the duration of the war. Total war was waged for the duration of the war, including the rape, pillage, and plundering of civilians and their property, and the bombing and burning down of entire cities, like Atlanta, Georgia, and Vicksburg, Mississippi, for example, and the total and complete destruction of Meridian, Mississippi, after Confederate soldiers had left in each cases. And so, and that paved the way, as Rothbard said, to the atrocities of war that occurred in the 20th century. Lincoln and his generals showed them the way of the mass murder of civilians for the 20th century. Rothbard and I are in total agreement on that. So when you look at all the things Lincoln did, as opposed to his rhetoric, his political rhetoric, he was an atrocity. He was a despot, a dictator, a big tax collector, a protectionist, a central planner, a civil liberties nightmare, and a white supremacist who wanted to deport all the black people out of the country. And the slaves were used as political pawns in a war that was not really about their freedom. And that was Rothbard's view, and it's also my view. And of course, I mentioned in the chat before I started talking here, is that Rothbard was a big fan of the writings of Robert Higgs on the issue of war, especially Higgs's book, Crisis in Leviathan, which I recommend to everyone. And you can do a Google search of Robert Higgs and get a lot of really outstanding articles on the whole issue of war. And Murray really, really liked Higgs's writing. And of course, Higgs is best known for elaborating on what economists for a long time have called the ratchet effect of the growth of government that occurs in a crisis such as a war. And I also would recommend the famous essay, The War is the Health of the State, by Randolph Bourne, spelled B-O-U-R-N-E. It's all over the web. It's very easy to find. And of course, the ratchet effect essentially says that in a situation like a war, government power is always ratchet up. Higher taxes, higher debt, more printing of money by the central bank, tax on civil liberties, regulation, price controls, commandeering of resources, the nationalization of industry. All of these things happen in wartime. And then when the war is over, the government only gives up some of those powers. The tax rates never go down all the way to where they were before the war. The regulations don't all disappear. And the industries often remain under government control to a much larger degree than they were before the war. And of course, it always strengthens the military-industrial complex, as it's called, any war of any kind. And so the ratchet effect leaves government on a permanently higher growth path and individual liberty on a permanently lower growth path, if you will, because the growth of government is always the enemy of freedom in today's world. We are long, long past the era in any government in America where it is performing only its basic functions of protecting life, liberty, and property. That era was surpassed and overthrown during the George Washington administration in America, and we've been on the road toward a plunder as the defining characteristic of government ever since. And so that's the ratchet effect. Now, during the Civil War, the ratchet effect included all these things I mentioned, the nationalization of the money supply with the National Currency Acts and the creation of greenbacks, the introduction of income taxation, which lasted until 1877, I think, and then it went out of existence until 1913, military conscription, the creation of the first class of federal employees who would become a permanent lobbying class for bigger welfare payments to them, namely Civil War veterans, the creation of the Internal Revenue Bureaucracy, protectionism, and the military-industrial complex was born also during the Civil War. All of these things ratcheted up during the Civil War. And then when Rothbard goes on to talk about World War I, I would invite everyone to talk about, to read his essay entitled World War I as Fulfillment. It's about the progressives, so-called, and their role in agitating for American entry into World War I. And I didn't put it on the reading list for this course. It's on my Political Economy of War reading course. It's on the web on Mises.org. And Rothbard mentioned some of the facts from that essay in this essay that I did put on the reading list for tonight. And some of the facts include the idea that these were the remnants of the Yankees. These were the remnants of the post-millennialists of the Civil War era, who sometimes called themselves pietists. They thought they were crusaders to create heaven on earth through the instrument of government. And of course, domestic government was not enough. It was not enough for these people to create heaven on earth only in America. They wanted to create heaven on earth in Europe and everywhere else too. That's why they advocated, one of the reasons why they advocated American entry into World War I, and Woodrow Wilson, of course, was one of them. President Woodrow Wilson was one of them, as Rothbard mentions. And so these were religious fanatics who wanted to use the instrument of the state, to achieve their version of heaven on earth via the state. I know it sounds crazy, but we're still stuck with these people today. They're only, we just call them neoconservatives. We don't call them millennialists or progressives that much anymore. And there's not that much difference, by the way, between the people who call themselves progressives today and the so-called neoconservatives. They both have this idea of creating some sort of ideal world through government intervention, foreign policy, military intervention, if necessary. And so Rothbard does a nice job of explaining who these people were and how almost every single one of them was a big cheerleader for American entry into World War I, but none of them went to, themselves to war. They were all chicken hawks along the lines of Rush Limbaugh, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Sean Hannity. You know, they promote war and they want everyone else's children to go to war, but not theirs, and not them, certainly not them. That's who the progressives were. And another reason why the progressives really wanted entry into war is they understood that with war there would be central planning of the economy, Soviet style, and they anticipated being able to make the argument that once the war was over, well, if we won the war and we used central planning, Soviet style, to commandeer resources, to nationalize industries, to fix prices and so forth, well, then after the war, maybe we can create prosperity with the same economic planning that we used during the war. And of course, the central planning during the war was a debacle that made the economy run much less efficient, less efficiently than it otherwise would have. But it did empower various special interest groups, especially corporations linked with government, who had untold numbers of sweetheart contracts as military contractors. And that was really the birth of the big military contracting system that exists to this day, whereby a dozen or two, maybe two dozen big corporations get almost all the contracts and all the work and all the billions of dollars in military procurement, and are very closely linked to the government itself. And for all practical purposes, they are part of government. Almost all of their money comes from government tax revenues. So that's the essence of what Rothbard is having to say about the progressives and war. And like I said, I welcome you to read his article, World War I as Fulfillment. It's a real eye-opener. It's one of my favorite Rothbard essays out there. It's rather long, so as a lot of his are, but just chock full of knowledge. And there's an interesting quote on page 15 of this article, the article on foreign policy, war and foreign policy, that where he describes Roosevelt. Fast forward to World War II, and here's what he says at the bottom of page 15 of that essay. World War II was the culmination and fulfillment of all these trends, : Franklin D. Roosevelt finally fastened upon American life the heady promise of the Wilsonian domestic and foreign program, permanent partnership of big government, big business, and big unions, a continuing and ever-expanding military-industrial complex, conscription, continuing and accelerating inflation, and an endless and costly role as a counter-revolutionary policeman for the entire world. Doesn't that sound like America today? The Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter world. Rothbard was writing this during the Carter administration, but he would, if he was writing it now, he would say the Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Obama world, and so forth, Bush to Obama. And there is little substantive difference among any of these administrations. It is corporate liberalism, the corporate state fulfilled. You could also call it fascism. It's essentially the system of fascism that has been adopted and began really with the progressives, and then was finally pushed over the cliff. Americans were into this system by Roosevelt during World War II. And of course, the same sort of ratchet effect happened on an even wider scale during World War II. Well, the marginal tax rate was increased to about 90%. And then it went down, but it only went down to 70% until the Reagan administration, until the 1980s. And so, and of course, government became permanently bigger. The military industrial complex ballooned out. There was massive demobilization after the war, but these institutions still grew, the military industrial complex after the war. And of course, with every succeeding war, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the War on Terror, as George Bush used to call it, and so forth. And the post-millennialists, if you will, and then their progeny, the progressives, were joined at the hip, really, by the so-called conservative movement of William F. Buckley, Jr. William F. Buckley, Jr., who worked for the CIA during World War II, and who probably worked for it for years thereafter as National Review editor, he did a good job of purging the so-called old right out of the conservative movement, the Murray Rothbards of the world, for example, the Albert J. Knox, the John T. Flynn, the people who were really much more libertarian-oriented and concerned about liberty and thought the role of government, if we're going to have government, should be to protect life, liberty, and property, not to be the policeman of the world. They were pretty much purged by Buckley from the movement. And Rothbard, in one of his other publications, quotes Buckley himself as saying in the 1950s that what America needs to fight the Cold War, so-called, is, and I quote, a totalitarian bureaucracy within our own shores. Those are the exact words of William F. Buckley, Jr. And this included a big CIA, a big FBI, a big military-industrial complex, and all the high taxes and nationalized industries and regulated industries and price controls that go along with it. And so all the things that we claim we're fighting wars against, you know, totalitarianism, socialism, big government, William F. Buckley, Jr. said, well, this is the defining characteristic of the conservative movement. Buckley was the original neocon. There was nothing conservative about him. He did not want to conserve the vision of the founding fathers as, of a government that would be limited by the Constitution to protect life, liberty, and property. It would be unimaginable for Thomas Jefferson or James Madison to say, well, we're at war with England, therefore we need a totalitarian bureaucracy within our own shores. That would be just the opposite of what these men like this would have said or even thought, I think. And so, but that was William F. Buckley sort of christening the conservative movement as a movement not in the direction of freedom for Americans, but as a movement in the direction of totalitarian government that would rival the opposing totalitarian government of the Soviet Union. That, in my opinion, is why so many of the neoconservatives are Lincoln idolaters. He showed them the way. He suspended habeas corpus. He orchestrated the mass murder of civilians who opposed, who no longer consented to being governed by Washington, D.C. He created the hugest government in the history of the planet up to his time. He created the biggest army ever to be assembled up to that point, the biggest and best armed in history. That's why they cheer him, because he's a role model for today, not that he preserved liberty for anybody. And as I said, I don't even I even consider the fact, as every economist should, of the alternative way of ending slavery, that is the peaceful way that the entire rest of the planet did. That was never seriously entertained. Lincoln did, by the way, mention compensated emancipation, but then he dropped it very quickly. But on deportation or colonization, this book that I mentioned, Colonization After Emancipation, there was no dropping of that idea. Lincoln was hard at work writing letters to the British Prime Minister, the British Foreign Minister, the Dutch, anybody who would take the black people off his hands till the day he died. He did not give up on that idea. He was tenacious about that idea. But on the issue of peacefully ending slavery, at least in parts of America, he wasn't so interested in that. And by the way, the Emancipation Proclamation did not free anybody because it only applied to rebel territory. That is, territory where the U.S. government was incapable of enforcing it. It specifically exempted all the areas of the United States where the U.S. Army was in control at the time. All the parishes in Louisiana, the entire state of West Virginia was exempted right in the document. And also, Lincoln said that it was a war document, meaning that if the war ended the next day, nothing would be done about slavery. The southern states that came back in the Union and continued to pay federal taxes could then do whatever they wanted with the slaves. That was Lincoln's position on that. And these are some of the facts that that I'm sure caused Murray Rothbard to understand that Lincoln was no libertarian, like some people have very foolishly claimed over the years. And of course, another thing that the Lincoln regime did was to make a god out of the American Union. All of a sudden, this idea that the Union is immutable, is permanent, and is worth mass murdering hundreds of thousands of people to keep it intact comes up. Where did this idea come from? It came from Lincoln and the Yankees, the New England Yankees of the mid 19th century. It certainly didn't come from the founding fathers, because the first Constitution was, as Rothbard mentioned, it was called the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, and then all of the states seceded from this Perpetual Union, which of course turned out to be not perpetual. And then the words perpetual union did not exist in the U.S. Constitution, which replaced the first Constitution, the Articles of Confederation. And the joining of the Union was voluntary. The states held political conventions, and they also took popular votes to decide whether they wanted to join or not to join. And but this idea that the Union was some sort of was divine and worth preserving at all costs was a brand new idea in 1860. But that's the idea Americans have lived with, and it's very similar to the Soviet Union as some sort of thing that must be held together at all costs, because, of course, the centralized power is in the interest of those, the one percenters, the less than 1% of the population, the elites, who always run the governments and who benefit from government. It's in their interest. But centralized governmental power is never in the interest of the citizens. Another word for centralized governmental power is monopoly government. And monopoly government is worth even worse than private monopoly. At least you can always tell private monopolists, no thanks, I don't want to consume any of your product. You can't say that to government without risking going to jail. You go to prison, the government will force you to live in a cage for years if you refuse to pay income tax in America, for example. And so another myth that was created out of all this is the myth of democracy being inherently conducive to peace. As Ludwig von Mises pointed out in his book Human Action, this was a popular theory beginning a long, long time ago, 150, 200 years ago, but Napoleon proved that wrong after the French democracy was instituted. And of course, what country has been more warlike in the 20th century and beyond than the democracy of the United States? Rothbard makes this point in his essay on war and foreign policy that the United States has been the most aggressive. We're the only country that has ever dropped a nuclear bomb on somebody. And we have endless wars. They're agitating today for a new war in Syria and Iran. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are not enough for the neoconservatives or the Obama administration today. But these are the origins of this kind of thinking of having an imperial empire. And of course, Rothbard does point out some of the history of this. He goes back to the Spanish-American War, but I would go back further to the Civil War being an imperialist adventure. And then the war on the Plains Indians that came next, immediately upon the completion of the American Civil War. And I would recommend to you one of my articles called The Culture of Violence in the American West that was published in the Independent Review in the fall of 2010 that talks about the war of the Plains Indians that took place for 25 years after the Civil War and laid the template for a lot of the waging of total war on civilians that occurred in the Spanish-American War And then later on, when the Filipinos objected to becoming part of the American Empire, we helped them, or the U.S. government helped the Filipinos shed their attachment to the Spanish Empire, but then we wanted to force them to be part of the American Empire. They revolted, and so Teddy Roosevelt sent troops in to kill 200,000 Filipinos, and he called them wild beasts, and as though they were inhuman beings, dehumanizing them, and they ended up killing some 200,000 Filipinos in the name of making them free as part of the American Empire. And so that laid the groundwork for the American Empire, didn't it? And then World War I was a natural extension of this sort of thinking that we should intervene in the affairs of Europe. But I personally see the Civil War as the breaking point in all of this, this type of thinking of transforming America into an empire rather than the constitutional republic that people like Thomas Jefferson hoped it would become. And so and we have proven that democracy doesn't necessarily lead to peace either, and therefore waging war in the name of spreading democracy is not necessarily a beneficial thing either. And that's the point Rothbard makes in this essay. And I see I've been going for about 46 minutes here, and so I think that's my overview of what I wanted to have to say about these articles, adding my own little tidbits or 2 cents on them. And there seems to be a lot of chatter here. I haven't been looking at the chatter, but I'll try to look through here now and see, as usual, if there are some questions here. Or you can add questions. Yes, FDR was carved into a mountain. And Newt Gingrich is a big fan of FDR, and somebody's pointing it out in the chat group. I quote him in my book, How Capitalism Saved America, as saying he was arguably the greatest man of the 20th century. He got us out of the Great Depression, and he won World War II, which is false, of course. He did not get us out of the Great Depression by any means. Yeah, Gar Alperovitz, he's a leftist, but his book on the atomic bomb is very good. Chris Branko mentions that. I have no idea about George Soros in Uganda or a non-war with Libya. Let's see. Any more questions? Let's see, George Smith says to everybody, well, if tariffs weren't the only cause of the Northern invasion, would you say it was the primary cause? I think it was, because the Republicans had the visions of empire, and the empire had to be financed. How's it going to be financed? Well, at the time, tariff collections were 90 to 95% of all revenue. And it's really irrelevant whether the South contributed 50% or 30% or 80%, whatever the percentage was, year by year of total federal tax revenues, they contributed a very large chunk, period. And so the elimination of that very large chunk of federal tax revenue was intolerable to Lincoln and the Republicans, and they were willing to wage war over it. And also, that they were willing to wage war so that they could economically exploit and plunder Southerners with the tariff. In my book, The Real Lincoln, I quote Northern newspaper after Northern newspaper before the war calling for the bombardment of the Southern ports because they understood that the South was moving in the direction of free trade. Its constitution, by the way, the Confederate Constitution outlaws protectionist tariffs altogether, whereas the North was moving in the direction of 50% tariffs. And they understand that the trade of the world will then go to the Southern ports in Boston and New York and Newport and Providence would dry up economically. And so the newspapers from those regions called for the U.S. Navy to bombard and destroy the southern ports. And this was before Fort Sumter. And it certainly was an important issue of the war. Oh, O'Reilly and me debating. O'Reilly doesn't debate, he pontificates. Eric Hagan wants to know if it's immoral to serve in the U.S. military today. Well, I recommend you to the essays of Lawrence Vance on LouRockwell.com, who makes the most convincing case that has ever been made that it is immoral to be a member of the U.S. military, because what the military does has nothing whatsoever to do today with defending America for the most part. And so you could argue that the existence of the military is a deterrent to invasion, but what war has the United States been involved in the past half century that was not an aggressive war? That's why the title of Rothbard's essay was Two Just Wars. He crosses out all the others as of the time he wrote the essay, which I think was late 80s, early 90s. I think it was early 90s. What conservative is worth contrasting with Rothbard? William F. Buckley Jr. That's who's his nemesis was on all of these issues as far as that goes. Let's see. John wants to know if I can defend Jefferson's purchase of Louisiana. I don't know why I need to defend Jefferson on anything. Any politician that I praise for doing specific things, and I condemn for doing specific bad things. Jefferson's, the author of Jefferson's book on the Jeffersonian Constitution addresses the Louisiana Purchase issue by saying that to Jefferson, the 10th Amendment was the essence or the cornerstone of the Constitution. And the Louisiana Purchase, of course, had nothing to do with the 10th Amendment. And he says that Jefferson's thinking was that it would expand the empire of liberty, and because the 10th Amendment was much more important than the rest of it. That's the defense of the Louisiana Purchase. But I've never argued that Thomas Jefferson was a perfect libertarian, so I'm not sure why anyone is interested in my defending him on anything. If he does good things, I'll praise him for it. If he does bad things, I'll criticize him for it, like any other politician. Lincoln was influential in creating the welfare state in that the Civil War Army, the veterans, the Union Army veterans, became the first political voting bloc in favor of welfare payments to themselves, military pensions. And Lincoln didn't champion that cause specifically, but by waging a massive war and being the first president under such a massive military machine, he was certainly partly responsible for the creation of that, but not the welfare state per se. Oh yeah, the elites call me, Tom Woods, Lou Rockwell, Ron Paul, racist, because they call everybody who disagrees with them racist, don't they? You don't have to be a supporter of the states' rights or the 10th Amendment, because they want to censor. That's their all-purpose strategy for censoring a debate, our side of the debate for limited constitutional government. That's the main purpose of it. They don't even cite what we say. They just say shady things like DiLorenzo, Woods, and Rockwell support decentralized government. Racists of the 19th century supported decentralized government. Therefore, DiLorenzo, Woods, Rockwell, and Ron Paul must be racist. That's sort of the length of their logic, and they're despicable, lying SOBs, of course, as is everyone associated with the Southern Poverty Law Center, or who even thinks of them as sort of a civilized group. By the way, the Southern Poverty Law Center, among other things, they're hardcore leftists who accept awards. The founder of it, Morris Dietz, accepted an award named after a famous communist of the 19th century as sort of a blood brother, philosophical blood brother. They're belligerent atheists at the Southern Poverty Law Center. They highlight a terrorist as one of their heroes, William Ayers. He's on their website. There's an interview with him that they do where they treat him like the second coming. And, of course, this is the guy who admitted to setting off bombs in the 60s at the nation's capital in New York City, murdering policemen and so forth and getting away with it. And he told the New York Times just a few years ago that he wished he would have set off even more bombs in the 1960s. And these are the kind of people that the Southern Poverty Law Center holds out as their heroes and idols for school children. In fact, the interview with him took place on a website that the Southern Poverty Law Center laughingly calls tolerance.org. But that's their shtick, is to try to censor our side of the debate, the libertarian side of the debate, by claiming that libertarians are somehow racist by wanting a smaller government. It's gotten so absurd now that people like Jesse Jackson Jr. are actually arguing now that if you criticize the welfare state, you're a racist because there are a lot of black people on welfare. And that's the level of intelligence of people who make these arguments. Let's see, how did Lincoln get the Northern soldiers to fight? Well, he drafted them by the hundreds of thousands. That's how he got them to fight for the most part. And of course, they shot deserters. You can find an article of mine on lewrockwell.com about desertion during the Civil War and how the Lincoln administration dealt with it, if you Google it. They shot deserters. And of course, there's a little book about this by James McPherson called What They Fought For, 1861 to 1865, where he went through hundreds of letters and diaries of Civil War soldiers and concluded that the average Southern soldier thought he was fighting against a tyrannical government that was invading his home and his town and his city and molesting his women and so forth and plundering his homeland. Whereas the typical Northerner thought he was fighting for the flag. And so patriotism was whipped up, especially after Fort Sumter. And then, of course, military conscription came in, and they shot people who ran away from the Army. That's a pretty good incentive to not run away. And, of course, there was a massive desertion crisis of the U.S. Army. I've written about that on lewrockwell.com, too. So, and of course, they used the hundreds of thousands of mercenaries from Europe as well by paying them or offering them free land under the Homestead Act. So there was conscription, there was the shooting of deserters, there was massive desertion anyway. You'll even read in the history books of as many as 80,000 Northern soldiers being AWOL on the eve of battle, 80,000 during the Lincoln administration, and they used mercenaries from Europe to fight the war. So there were mercenaries from Germany, for example, who did not even speak English, who were sent down south to teach the descendants of Thomas Jefferson what it really meant to be an American. That's essentially what they were told they were doing. Let's see, Eric wants to know if I find the glorification of the American soldier objectionable. I certainly do, because it's really the glorification of the American foreign policy elite that this hold the soldier up as a prop. And of course, it's very easy to propagandize and lie to and fool 18-year-olds. They're the perfect victims for this. And so, and again, I recommend, there's an article by Robert Higgs, what's the title? I think it's something like The Song That Is Irresistible. Go online and find Robert Higgs. I think it's The Song That Is Irresistible. It was his speech that he gave accepting a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Mises Institute a couple of years ago in New York City. And it's online, I'm pretty sure, at Mises.org. And it explains this question in great detail about why it is that young boys are just the perfect cannon fodder for the foreign policy establishment. Well, Rothbard was well received among libertarians, but he was excoriated and hated by the conservatives, who were really the neoconservatives. William F. Buckley Jr. was so gross and inhuman that when Murray Rothbard died, he wrote an obituary of him in National Review magazine that was very nasty and rude and insulting. That's the kind of person William F. Buckley Jr. was. Oh yes, Larry Arn, he's one of the biggest Lincoln idolaters in America, and that whole course, when they do mention Lincoln, it's almost always or exclusively about Lincoln's rhetoric and speeches. but almost never, ever about anything he actually did. And so you can make Lincoln or any other politician out to be a saint or a god if you just look at the prettier sounding speeches that he or his speech writers presented. But if you look at their actual behavior, you get a very different story. And so I think taking the Constitution course with anyone associated with Hillsdale College or the Claremont Institute is a waste of money. Yes, thanks to George Smith. There's a link to the book by McPherson on what they fought for. Yeah, I wrote a review of that book on Mises.org years ago. I think Jeff Tucker gave it a title like May the Battle Flag Long Wave or something like that. And it was basically a review of McPherson's book. So you can, if you don't want to get the book or read the book, you can probably find my article on Mises.org. Roger, is there a southern counterpart to the Lincoln Memorial? Well, not that I know of. There are memorials in Richmond, Virginia, to Robert E. Lee and Jeff Stuart, and Stonewall Jackson, things like that, but nothing on the magnitude of the Lincoln Memorial. The South was devastated economically by the war, and they had no money for memorials like that. The winners usually construct all the big memorials, not the losers. If you look at the Lincoln Memorial itself, on the front of the arms of the Lincoln Memorial are the fasces, F-A-S-C-E-S, or the Roman symbol for imperial power. And there's Abe Lincoln. My old friend Clyde Wilson says that the image of America was transformed by the Lincoln Memorial from George Washington on his white horse to a corporate lobbyist in an armchair. And, of course, Lincoln was a corporate, what today we would call a corporate lobbyist for the railroad industry. And the Lincoln Memorial, he's sitting there in an armchair. Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny. And he does look like an emperor in his memorial, to be sure. Okay. Any more questions, folks? Looking at the chat here. Well, it looks like we're running out of gas, I guess. I knew someone would make a comparison about Planet of the Apes. My next course, I don't know. We're getting closer to the holidays. I'm thinking of what course I might offer next. I might repeat one of them that I've already taught, or think of something unique. I thought this was unique, Rothbardian Analysis of the State, and I hope you learned a lot. I'll decide that in the next few days as far as what I'm going to do with another course. Feel free to write me and make recommendations, by the way. I'll entertain suggestions from students as far as that. Because Mises is considering a constitutional course, I don't know. Not that I know of. Tom Woods would be good at that, but thinking of doing his own online courses outside of the Mises Academy. The debt crisis in Europe, my thoughts, what a shame. If it leads to the implosion of the European welfare state, it's all good. It's all good. Bill wants a dinner on him, I guess, for everybody. This is addressed to all participants. Night for the Mises Circle in Houston. I don't know what I'm going to be doing, if I'm going to be there the night before, but sure, give me an email. Think about it. Eric wants to know, other than Lincoln, what are my major areas of interest? Well, I've written, I'm interested in all kinds of things. I mean, in my books, I've written about Hamilton, Hamilton's Curse, how capitalism saved America is another interest of mine. So I've been interested in sort of Rothbardian revisionist history with an economic spin in the past 15 years or so, and that's sort of my focus of research for now. But I guess we're running out of substantive comments. Well, thanks again, all of you, for participating, and I will work up another quiz for those of you who would like to get a grade for the class, and I'll send it along to Danny in the next couple of days. And thanks for coming. Thanks for listening. I hope you learned a lot, and I hope you continue to learn, taking these classes and reading on your own. It's a fun way to learn. I wish this was around when I was younger, although I've been educating myself my whole life as far as that's concerned. And I hope all of you do too. We need you for the freedom movement. And have a good night.